Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. 2 hours of open forum today. You can ask whatever you like, whether you're Catholic or not. We're open to anyone. We're open to any question. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And both hours, we've got the inimitable, the guy you cannot imitate. There is no imitation for him. It's Joe Heschmeyer. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I actually got a story about that.
About inimitable?
When I was in seminary.
All those modifiers I said, by the way, mean the same thing.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. I didn't know if you had caught that subtlety of my...
A number of my classmates in seminary dressed up as me 1 year for Halloween. So I am definitely imitable.
They did?
They did.
And how did they do? What do you wear if you're going as the same
white button-down shirt I would wear like every day. Uh-huh. I mean, I had like a very, I would always wear a white button-down t-shirt, or white red button-down shirt rather, and carry a Diet Coke. So...
Well, it's good not to be predictable.
Yeah, some of them did some padding, too, to make their physique
now that
look more
is,
like mine.
That's mm-hmm. not right. 888-318-7884, the number. It's Catholic Answers. That's the name of the show, but you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. Maybe you're interested in something about the Catholic Church. Maybe there's something that bothers you about the Catholic Church. Maybe there's something you'd just like to have an explanation for. Whether you're Catholic or not, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. I saw you in here in the studio just an hour ago with our good friend and colleague Trent Horn. He's in town.
He is.
Am I supposed to say that?
We've got a chair saved for him.
We're saving a chair for him. Maybe Trent will come in here and answer a few questions while you're here. And that would be fun.
If I start totally failing, then hopefully Trent will come in and rescue me.
It doesn't seem likely that that's going to happen. 888-31-TRUTH, 888-318-7884. Joe is here in town with us because of doing some filming and various things, including writing, and also working with us on some things. Joe's a very wise person, so it's good to have him around to ask, how should we do this, how should we do that? Trent comes into town to... record classes and episodes of things, and it's just great when the guys are around. And I think you're going to move to California now. I'm pretty sure you're going to move to California.
Let me put it this way.
Yeah.
I looked at what we would have to make in order to have a similar sized house.
Come on, Joe.
If I become like a tech billionaire, we'll be here.
It is very expensive to live here. Let me tell you how to get a relatively inexpensive house here in California.
Move here like 30 years ago?
I was going to say 25.
Okay.
But yeah, if you could just buy it 25 years ago, you'd be in great shape.
California is the Bitcoin of states.
What does that mean? Like, I don't know what that means.
You missed it by 10 years by the time you're talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This state is tough, man. It's tough on people. You want to do some questions or should we?
we can continue to opine about California, but I'd rather talk about the Catholic Church.
I feel like I could, like, as a citizen of the state of California, a long time now citizen of the state of California, I feel like I complain about the state of California a lot. And something that I do, I notice when I'm talking, like emceeing an event or something in the Midwest, is I tell a lot of California jokes and they all get them. They all know exactly what I'm talking about. And they appreciate them.
Yes.
They don't always appreciate them here, but if you're...
No, my wife is from California. And so this is her lived daily reality.
Yeah.
Like when she met my parents, they were just wowed that a faithful Catholic woman was...
Came from California?
Yeah, lived her whole life in California. They were really trying to... You know, like as much as Californians have stereotypes of the flyover states... It goes both ways.
Well, that's the thing. The sad thing, though, is if you grew up here and you've been around for a long time, you love this state. I love
it's
the state of California.
State.
And with a great history
and
so much
cool stuff.
I was
joking when I said I would rather talk about California than the church, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I was going to make a fascinating point. Never mind. We're going to callers. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I have too much fun when you're on. Ben in West Virginia, watching on Catholic.com. Glad to have you, Ben. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Joe and Cy, thank you for taking my call. And don't feel bad. I complain a lot about Gomorrah, California often as well.
Wait, I think we dropped Ben. Oh, Ben dropped. Oh, I'm so sorry. All right, go ahead, Ben.
No, there's plenty of room in West Virginia. Anyway,
There's a reason for that, though.
No, now, Joe, have you ever been to West Virginia?
Truth be told, West Virginia, like California, beautiful state.
Absolutely beautiful
state. Yeah, the mountainous
area.
Yeah. I love both states.
And us Westerners, we think everything east of the Mississippi, not that good looking. You know, like
no, West Virginia is gorgeous.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, right. All right, go ahead, Ben from West Virginia. What's the question?
All right. So, Joe, why do Jews and Catholics alike no longer offer animal sacrifice?
Ah, great. Great question. It's funny you phrase it that way because it's two different reasons. So Jews don't offer sacrifice anymore because the temple's not there. So in 70, with the Jewish rebellion from the Romans, the temple was destroyed. And without the temple and without an operating priesthood, you don't have animal sacrifice. This is what's called the diaspora. So in theory, if the Jews ever rebuilt the temple, animal sacrifice would resume. And those communities like the Samaritans, who you'll still find in Jerusalem or in Israel, rather, they offer sacrifice on Mount Gerizim, which is still there. So they'll still do animal sacrifice to this day. But Jews won't, you know, non-Samaritans. As for Christians, our reason is different. It's that Christ fulfills what was prefigured in animal sacrifices. So we don't need animal sacrifices. Hebrews 10 lays this out. Beginning in verse 11 until verse 14, says that every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, then to wait until his enemies should be made a stool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. It goes on from there, but you get the idea that animal sacrifices were as much a reminder of sin as anything else. They couldn't ultimately deal with the problem of sin. The Yom Kippur sacrifices, the sacrifices throughout the year, they weren't enough to save us ultimately or take away our sins. And Jesus does that through the blood he sheds on the cross. And so the Mass every day, we offer that once and for all sacrifice to the Father, and we continually reapply it because that's the sacrifice that actually saves us. Animal sacrifice was just a preparation for what Christ was doing.
Ben, what do you think?
I think that's very helpful, and I was curious as well. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, was it Jeremiah that prophesied that after the coming of the Son of Man, there would only be one sacrifice
offered
given,
throughout the world?
And that would be the sacrifice of, yes, the sacrifice of Thanksgiving, which is where we get the word Eucharist.
I know there's this prophecy in Malachi 1:11, which talks about that. I'm trying to think if there's something in Jeremiah. There might be something in Jeremiah as well. If so, I'm not remembering the passage you're referencing. But I know there are such. The most specific one, and the one the church fathers regularly point to, is Malachi 1:11 through, I think, 13, in which it talks about the sacrifices offered by the Jewish priests being rejected. Because they defiled the table of the Lord, while one sacrifice would be offered from the rising of the sun to its setting. And you'll hear that language in the Mass, in the Eucharistic prayers.
Ben, thanks very much. If you'll take my quiz, you can get a copy of Joe's new book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. It's a one-question quiz. If Jeremiah was an animal, what kind of animal would he be?
Ooh.
Jeremiah.
I feel like there's an inside joke.
It's a lame three dog night joke from the 1970s.
Jeremiah was. Come on. Give him the book. He needs it. Hang on the line, Ben. We're going to give you the book. I'll give the answer to that one right after this. Catholic Answers Live. Open forum. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Hang on, Ben.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, why don't you air these people? And I said, no, because I don't think they're Catholic. He says, by what right do you have to say that? I said, I own the network.
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Tonight, 8 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Three Dog Night. Joy to the world. Jeremiah was a...
bullfrog.
Bullfrog.
And a good friend of mine.
I know. It's an interesting combination. He was a bullfrog and a good friend of mine.
It really, like, when people lament the meaninglessness of modern music, I want them to remember this is what the prior generations offered us.
Well, you say the prior generations, but that music is from my generation. Why do you say the prior? Like we're like we're dead or something. That's the music I listened to as a kid. Three Dog Night.
Yeah, there might be like two or
just
dogs
I'm gonna
left.
Sing on the way to Shambhala now, just for you. Ready?
Can we please take calls?
Owen in San Francisco, California, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Owen, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
I'm sorry about everything we said about California, Owen.
Well, I want to get out of California.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, a sane person. Okay, go ahead.
I help out with instruction during confirmation classes at the parish I go to. Mm-hmm. And we use a book which was reviewed by the subcommittee of the catechism. And inside the book, it says that it may be used as a supplemental to other basal catechetical texts. So my question is, how strict is that statement? And would it be sinful to continue to help out, knowing that they use it as their primary text, not a supplemental text?
Let me just clarify one thing with you real quick. Are you opposed to whatever this book is, or is it a book that you think should be used more, just to get a better idea of where we are?
I think it's a pretty good book. Could be better, but not bad by any means.
Okay, so the USCCB, the United States Catholic Bishops Subcommittee on the Catechism, says it could be used as a supplement. In your parish, they're using it as the primary book, and you want to know if that's a kind of disobedience that you have to get away from?
Correct. Yes.
All right, Joe?
And they don't do it knowingly, I'm sure.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I would maybe bring that up. That's specifically looking at catechesis on the catechism. Like, that is specifically, because the whole issue with basal text is, are they referencing back to the catechism paragraphs? Like, if you're trying to explain the catechism, you don't want a book that is far enough removed that it's not really unpacking the catechism. I don't think that, my understanding is not that that means that you just can't use it in another context. I don't know the specifics of the use here. And I know they actually stopped, I think they stopped reviewing a lot of the stuff that's in question. So I'm a little stumped by this question because I don't want to say ignore it, but
I really want to say ignore it, but I don't
feel confident. I don't want to give you inadvertent instructions to disobey. I would say, I don't know what level of authority a subcommittee on the catechism has. I know they assist the bishops, who are the ones who actually have that authority. But if the bishop isn't insisting on it, I'd say you are certainly free. Like, the bishop is the primary catechist in his diocese. So if he's fine with using it, I don't think you need to second guess that.
Does that help you, Owen?
Yeah, I mean, do you know how I would go about to know if he's fine with using it?
I would ask the pastor. I'd bring this to him. I would give him the exact questions you gave us, and maybe see if he, wants to take it up. In fact, the USCCB on their website talks about what to do if the diocese uses texts that aren't on the so-called conformity list. So, I mean, again, like, the USCCB's committee here doesn't trump the authority that is by divine right vested in the bishop.
Or probably even by law in the pastor. I mean, I'm just guessing.
Yeah, but in terms of the primary catechist for the diocese, it's the bishop.
So can you take the book to the pastor and talk to him about it, Owen?
Yeah, go to the pastor of the parish that I go to.
Okay. Thanks, Owen. Appreciate the call, and many blessings in your work with young people, or maybe it's older people. I don't know who you're helping to know the faith. Not enough of us do that, and God bless you that you are.
Younger, but and thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right. Let's go to Miguel in Rosenberg, Texas, also listening on the Catholic Answers app. Miguel, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
All right. Well, I had a question about if the Catholic faith, or, you know, has a like a team or something that monitors these pop up religious groups. There's one called BAOC Network.
Wait. So it's religious networks that pop up, and you want to know if the church monitors them?
Yeah, the way they have funds, they're like these videos and movies they make, like the commentators, people are praising the videos and like going crazy, like best religious or best explanation of this or that, and it's far from the scriptures. It's like they
I see. I see what you're saying, Miguel, but I don't know, Joe.
I actually had a little trouble hearing the question. It was about what was the...
Okay, so there's like these religious websites and networks will pop up explaining the scriptures.
Oh.
And he wants to know if the Catholic Church monitors them at all, because many of them are teaching things that are not actually scriptural. Am I right about that, Miguel?
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't check a bunch. It's like I usually ignore them, but like this video that came up, it looked well, produced and all that stuff, and the comments were in the thousands, and the likes were in the thousands, and it was just like, they just didn't, no one there cared to, verify the guy that's teaching them that,
Was it purported to be Catholic or just generally Christian?
I don't know what it is, man. Like, I didn't even want to say it on
this. Okay, well,
to your question.
As a general matter, no. The only things that would really come across the desk of the bishop or any kind of, like, official church review would be something published by, like, a Catholic theologian in a more formal way. A YouTube video, especially a YouTube video not by a Catholic, isn't going to be something that the church is going to be reviewing or monitoring. I just checked, and as of February 2020, every minute, 500 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. So in other words, even if you spent your entire life sun up to sundown with no sleep watching everything that was out there, you wouldn't come close. For every hour, there's 30,000 hours of new content. So, you're falling 29,999 hours behind even in the hour you are watching. So it's literally impossible for the church to effectively like monitor everything someone says online without, it's a totally like Wild West kind of situation, which means, take anything you're hearing with a grain of salt. If you've got a particular question about a doctrinal claim, we're happy to try to tackle those. You can compare them to what scripture says, what the catechism says, what the church has said in official teachings. Frequently you can Google the word, and then if you type in Catholic or Catholic Answers or Catholic.com after the word or phrase you're looking for, you will not infrequently find an answer specifically to the question, because even a lot of the new stuff popping up is repeating the same old claims that have been debunked 100 times before.
There is a thing in the Catholic Church in the United States called the Kennedy Directory, also called the Catholic Directory, and it's a directory of every apostolate that has been approved by a bishop in the United States. So if it's not there, it's not approved by a bishop. And that's not, it's just one way you might, if you were, are these people legit Catholic or not? I mean, there's lots of stuff that's approved by bishops that might be good, might be bad. I mean, we're in the directory, and some people like us, some people don't, but it's at least a place to start if you want to know if something at least has the official approval of a Catholic prelate. I'm going to keep moving. Miguel, thank you very much for the question. We're going to go to Jerry in Rio Vista, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jerry, go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. That was a good segue, using the word legit Catholic, just because that's my topic, actually.
Okay.
I was reading the article in the National Catholic Register about a priest who unfortunately was using the wrong formula in baptizing. He would say, "We baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son," instead of "I." And so now there is all kinds of questions about, whether or not people who were not baptized validly because the formula wasn't valid, maybe even those who went on to become, you know, confirmed or ordained priests. And I don't want to get legalistic about this, I'm just trying to figure out what the answer could possibly be. If a priest, say, who was ordained but not validly baptized, and yet he confers sacraments on others, whether it's, you know, reconciliation, even Holy Communion, etc., what happens to those people who, in good faith, went to get the sacraments from a priest, perhaps who, not by not any knowledge of his own, was not actually validly ordained?
That's a great question. It's an unfortunate one, because baptism is the gateway to the sacramental life, meaning all of the other sacraments right. require baptism. So in the case you're talking about, this arose in was caught in the Diocese of Phoenix. It had happened here in San Diego before that. Father Andres was using the improper formula, and so he resigned as pastor. He wrote a very apologetic letter. I don't think he realized the severity of what he had done. And his full-time ministry now is just trying to undo the damage he caused by invalidly baptizing people, because it has all of those downstream effects that you described. Now, in the theology of the church and in canon law, there is the idea that, you know, the church can supply jurisdiction. That doesn't apply here. So you'll sometimes hear people say, "Oh, well, the church can supply jurisdiction even if, you know, it's lacking." No, that's not something the church has the ability to do. The church can't make an unbaptized person a worthy recipient of sacraments that require baptism. And it's clear even from Jesus's own practice at the Last Supper, in which the Last Supper isn't just a free-for-all for anyone on the street who wants to come to it. It's those initiated followers of Christ. It's a meal for the disciples. And so someone who isn't baptized into that discipleship isn't an eligible recipient for confirmation, for communion, or even for holy orders. So that, as you've correctly identified, creates all sorts of downstream consequences where those ordinations would be invalid. God has bound us by the sacraments and is not himself bound by the sacraments. So we would prayerfully entrust the irreversible damage to the hands of God, that especially in a situation like this where maybe no one intended harm, and certainly the recipient of the sacraments didn't intend any harm, but it really does speak to why it's important to do what the church lays out, you know, do the red, say the black, and don't modify the sacramental rites, because you can cause some really serious damage.
Yeah, that's I'm familiar with the concept of, you know, God not being bound by. I know he binds himself to the sacraments, but he's not bound by his own sacraments, and that through his grace, I just have confidence that all of these people are okay, because God knows what's in their heart. I submitted that question through the Facebook page of the National Catholic Register and got polite replies. Some of them were very legalistic, basically saying, "Hey, it's not valid, period." Some others, kind of agreeing with my notion that I just laid out. But it's a tough one, and I just wasn't quite sure, really how to answer that. If somebody asked me, "Well, what about these people who went to confession to this priest who was not validly ordained because he never received the valid baptism?" And that's a tough one.
Yeah, I would just say no one's going to go to hell on a technicality. No one's going to go to hell because
right.
through no fault of their own, as an infant, the priest didn't say the words he was supposed to say, and they had no way of knowing that. But nevertheless, there's a whole
right.
world of graces that are opened up to you in the sacrament of baptism. And as I said, the other sacraments are dependent upon it. So we don't want to play games with it. And so someone who believes that they were invalidly baptized should seek to have that remedied. You know, find out as best you can if you were validly baptized. If need be, have a conditional baptism. There are ways of addressing that. You shouldn't play games with it. That's all I'd say.
Jerry, thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you for that answer. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much for the question. Actually, I had meant to ask you that myself, because I saw that in the news
Yeah. It's just devastating news.
It is. It really is. Don't play games. Like, just in the same way that you wouldn't change the words to the Our Father, because it'd be really arrogant to do so. I mean, I hope no one listening would change the words to the Our Father.
I've heard people have.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe I can't come up with an absurd enough to speak to what people have or haven't done.
Yeah.
But you know, hopefully most people listening would say, that'd be really arrogant. There are a lot of otherwise solid Catholics who think it's fine to adapt the words to make them more relevant. Leave them alone. The whole point of corporate worship is you're not improvising the words. There's a part for that called the homily. Outside of that, the church has one right. Like, this is what the whole fight about is, like, how are we going to worship together as Roman Catholics according to one Roman rite? You can't argue that and then turn around and play with the Roman rite and make it your own idiosyncratic version. I would just say, like, it's disrespectful, whether you intend it to be or not. It's disrespectful of the liturgy. It's disrespectful of God and of the church. And in cases like this, when you're messing with the sacraments, it can cause real damage.
Jerry, thanks very much for the call. Our number is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. His latest book is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, getting rave reviews and actually selling quite well, I have noticed. Congratulations on that, Joe.
Thank you. Thanks for promoting it constantly.
Have I promoted it constantly?
You've done a really good job of promoting it on the air.
Well, thank you. Do you have anything you'd like to promote? You can do it when we come back.
I hear Cy has a show called Catholic Answers Live.
Okay.
Oh, maybe a book, too.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. There's lots of folks on the line. Lots of great questions to come. Right back with more Open Forum.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll continue our series with Dominican Father Ezra Sullivan on developing habits of virtue. Plus news, weather, sports, and more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett. Your host, Joe Heschmeyer, is our guest. And what did I do with my ad? I just had an ad to read here, Joe. It's funny. No, I didn't throw it away. It's not in there. It's about your book. I know your book's on sale. Don't worry. Oh, here it is, down next to me. You do this call.
This is literally his job.
I hate when you do that. All right. Chad in Kentucky, listening on the Catholic Answers app is growing. Lots of people using the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading it onto your phone. Chad, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call. The question I have is, I'm a recent convert to Catholicism.
Welcome
going
home.
On 3 years now.
Wow.
I have three small children. My wife is currently pregnant with our fourth child.
Well, congratulations on many things for you, Chad.
Congratulations here.
I appreciate it. Myself and my kids and my soon-to-be fourth kid, we're all going to be Catholic. My wife has chosen not to come into the church as of yet. The question I have is this. She talked about last night wanting to get a hysterectomy after the birth of this fourth child. We've already talked about contraception and the church's stance on it and whatnot. I told her that I wasn't approving of it. She said that she may or may not do it with or without my approval. So the question is, where does that put me morally in relations to her consummating the marriage?
Gotcha.
Continually after the fact.
Right.
Because I don't want it to be a mortal sin for me to knowingly have a sterile,
union. All right.
Right. Yeah. No, very good question. You're not trying to contracept in any way, shape, or form. Right. Like,
I've actually talked her out of temporary contraceptives
exactly,
before.
Exactly. So,
which is the reason why we got the fourth child.
You're not. Congrats. In a situation like that, like, you do what you can to dissuade her from interrupting the marital act. But if she goes ahead with that, you're not the one interrupting it in any way. And you're not morally on the hook for things that are outside of your control there. And so in a situation like that, a woman who's had a hysterectomy, for whatever reason, if you're not intending to contracept, because sometimes women will have to have hysterectomies for medical reasons unrelated to contraception. In those cases, they're not told they have to live celibately for the rest of their life, because they're not, by the design, like if they're doing it to impede the marital act, to keep it from being unitive and procreative, then that's wrong. But the mere fact that a woman can't get pregnant or is less likely to get pregnant or whatever the situation may be in the particulars isn't enough to make the marital act invalid. So you are still able to proceed to live an ordinary marital life if she ignores everything you've said. I think it's the kind of thing that would harm a marriage, especially in a situation where the husband is saying, please don't do this, and then the wife says, I'm going to do it anyway. For a lot of reasons, I think that harms the marriage. But it's not the thing that would make like marital relations invalid. You can continue to live as husband and wife in that way.
Okay, Chad?
One little quick thing.
Okay.
I'm very distraught over this. It's hurt my heart. You know what I mean?
Chad, I'm just going to step in here just for a second, because I don't know if Joe has this experience, but my wife and I needed special permission from the bishop to get married because we have disparity of cult. That is, my wife was not a Christian when we married. And so I have a long experience of the kind of anxiety that comes with, I renewed kind of my Catholic faith and it was very confusing for her and for both of us. All I would say to you is I know that hurts very, very much. But in my experience, looking back on it, the only regret I have is that I wasn't kinder about everything. That you can't control. Jesus doesn't expect you to control. He expects you to love and be generous, say the truth, and then let it go and let his plan take its course. So that's coming from me personally. Joe will have to tell you if that's good advice
I think it's beautiful advice. And Cy's right. My wife is a better Catholic than I am. So I don't
have... Low bar.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Set you up for that one. I regretted it immediately. But no, in all seriousness, I hope listeners are saying a prayer for you and for your wife right now. Because it can be a really frightening thing when one person becomes Catholic and the other one isn't. It can be frightening for both of you. And all of the changes that introduces to the way you've lived marriage and the way you're going to live marriage, I'd say be incredibly generous, incredibly patient, incredibly loving. And more than all the theological arguments in the world, if you are a better husband as a Catholic than you were as whatever you were before becoming a Catholic, that is going to be a convincing and really resounding argument for the faith.
Does any of that help you, Chad?
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot.
God bless you. You sound like just a good man, a good father, a good husband. God bless you, Chad. You know what, Darren? We have a book on contraception, which is leaving my brain right now. inseparable. We want, if Chad wants it, will you send it to him? Because it might be something they could read together. Thanks again, Chad. Appreciate that call. The number is 888-318-7884. We're going to Pittsburgh now. Jonathan in Pittsburgh listening. Is the Catholic Answers app just suddenly taking over the whole world? It's everywhere. Jonathan listening on the Catholic Answers app. Go ahead with your question, please, for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hello again. My questions are these, and they're mainly about St. Clement of Alexandria. I don't want to get confused. Clement of Rome with Clement of Alexandria.
Okay.
Anyway, my first question is what is the gospel according to Hebrews? And my second question is there a secret gospel of Mark? Because these are apparently two questions related to the saint that have been conspired over the years.
Okay, good questions. Clement's reference to the gospel of Hebrews is not the same as the epistle to the Hebrews. It's considered a lost gospel. It's not literally a gospel in the sense. It's not an inspired gospel. It's not a gospel that was in like widespread use in the early church. It was some kind of writing that had some of the teachings of Jesus and seems to have been itself based on the four gospels and particularly based on Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So it's similar to the so-called synoptic gospels. And all we have now are our little fragments of it. I guess I just mentioned that Alexandria is a little bit outside of the hub of early Christianity. So you'll occasionally find some strange texts that have kind of made their way into the community there, especially in the early days. That sort of gets worked out. But occasionally when you're reading Clement, he'll quote these things and you think, that was not actually inspired scripture. But it maybe was just a document, like a Christian writing or a Jewish writing that was circulating around. And it points to the fact that there was sometimes some confusion about what the boundaries of the Bible were in the very early days. Does that help clarify? And then, there's no secret gospel of Mark in terms of like an authentic one. There's a so-called secret gospel of Mark, but it's not really by Mark.
Okay. I always knew that Alexandria was like the curse of where all Gnostic stuff was, you know, because that's where most of the Gnostic gospels and everything were written, or at least the copies that we have at the moment. So thank you for the answers. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe if I should add one thing, the Epistle to Barnabas, or Epistle of Barnabas, rather, which is not written by the famous Barnabas in the Bible, It does the same thing where it doesn't always have a clear delineation of which things are and aren't scripture, which may just be that this is the edge of kind of where Christianity has gotten, and then they come to a kind of a clearer understanding of the faith pretty quickly thereafter.
I'm going to let that be it because we got to take a quick break. We got lots of folks on the line, but we're doing this for 2 hours today, 2 hours of open forum with our guest, Joe Heschmeyer. Here's a little news about Joe. His bestseller, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, is now available in bulk format for parish or personal distribution. When you buy a case of 20, your cost goes down to $3 a copy. Order your case or cases today at shop.catholic.com. This might be one you want to give out for Lent in your parish, at your prayer group, maybe your women's group or men's group. A very fine book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, on bulk sale right now at shop.catholic.com.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Cecilia Flannery, Director of Divine Mercy Radio. The world needs Catholic radio because it changes lives and saves souls for Jesus. It brings each of us closer to Him. And when you're closer to Jesus, there's a very good chance you will spend eternity with Him. Catholic radio not only changes your life in this world, it changes it for all of eternity.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Whole lot of folks on the line. That's okay. We got Joe Heschmeyer here, apologist Joe Heschmeyer, here in town with us, actually in San Diego, for several weeks while we do a lot of work together. And it's been great to have Joe around. But you get, those of you who've been listening to the show the last month, you know, we're trying to kill him by making him work constantly. But you doing okay?
Yeah, you're holding up. Right. I'm going to die happy at least.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. I'm very glad to hear it. Do your kids like it out here?
Oh, they love it out here.
They do?
I mean, they went from having to be bundled up constantly, and we'd spend like 10 minutes getting them dressed, 5 minutes outside, then they get cold and come inside, to just like go play outside with the orange trees and the lemon groves.
You're making it sound good, Joe. Let's go to Mike. Now I feel bad. We just talked about how nice it is in California right now. And this next caller is in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
They haven't had a good run lately.
What do you think it's like right now in Green Bay, Wisconsin?
I guess it's cold.
Like it's literally 85 degrees out today. Mike, watching on YouTube in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you are next. Go ahead, Mike, with your question for Joe.
Hey, thank you for the call. You know, I've got a few friends live not too far from you up in Escondido, and every time he starts talking about California and wanting to move, I just let him know that gas is under $3 a gallon up here.
So. Oh, yeah. We got a new employee, and he came from the Midwest, and he goes... we were driving together the other day, and the gas was $4.59, and he goes, I know I'm a Californian because that looks like a good gas price to me. Like, that looks like a deal.
My mother-in-law burnt me so badly once on a family thread. I sent a picture of gas when it was under $2 last year, and she said, that's because there's nowhere to go.
Oh, that, come on. Now, there's plenty of places to go in Wisconsin, beautiful Wisconsin. You can go to the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Please.
Go ahead, Mike.
The other place to go, of course, is Champion, Wisconsin, where the only church-approved apparition of Mary took place. And that's what leads to my question is public versus private revelation. I was listening to a podcast last week of somebody you may know. His name's Jimmy Akin, and he brought up the apparitions in Rwanda. And I know that if it's private, you don't have to follow it, believe in it, whatever. But some of the things that happened and that do happen and that actually come true, I guess I'm wondering who makes that decision as to whether it's, you know, this was three young girls, so it was considered private, but a whole lot of people knew about it and were aware of it.
Yeah.
Who decides public versus private and whether it's worth following or not?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's really two questions in there. The first one is public versus private, and the second is worthy of belief, because there are private revelations that are still worthy of belief. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. First, the private versus public distinction is really clear. So in the Epistle of Jude, in verse 3, it refers to the faith delivered once for all to the apostles. This is what the church calls the deposit of faith or public revelation. And De Verbum, in paragraph 10, says sacred tradition and sacred scripture form one sacred deposit of the word of God committed to the church. In other words, in the revelation of Christ, in the New Testament kind of revelation, that's the fullness of revelation. That's all you're required to believe in, is what is revealed in New Testament revelation, meaning like by Christ, which is then committed to writing and committed to a sacred tradition. So if it doesn't happen in the first century or before, it by definition is not part of public revelation. Anything that happens after the death of John cannot be public revelation in the sense the church is talking about, because it's after the time of the deposit. We're given the deposit of faith. We're given the Christian faith, in other words, and then we spend centuries meditating upon it, And we may come to understand it better, but we don't get any new content. We don't get any new teachings that weren't there before. Does that part make sense? I'll explain the relationship that has to like private revelations in a second. But does that first part make sense?
Makes sense?
Okay. So then, in addition to that, the Virgin Mary or the saints may appear to particular visionaries or seers, or you know, there are even times where mystics have an appearance of Jesus, and those may be real, but those are still private, meaning you're not bound to believe that, just like you're not bound to believe your neighbor's dream if they say they had a dream in which Jesus spoke to them. Like, maybe he did. I'm not ready to say he didn't do it, but you're not required as a Christian to believe that. You're free to take it or leave it. And so in paragraph 67 of the Catechism, we're told that throughout the ages, there have been so-called private revelations, some of which have been recognized by the authority of the church. They do not belong, however, to the deposit of faith. It is not their role to improve or complete Christ's definitive revelation, but to help live more fully by it in a certain period of history. So take Our Lady of Cabejo, the one in Rwanda, for example. Mary is reminding people on the verge of genocidal violence of the need to turn back to the gospel, and that if they don't, there's going to be this horrible outbreak of violence. People were free to ignore her, and a lot of people did, and the message came true. But no one's going to be condemned because they didn't know it was a real apparition or not. The only people an apparition is binding on are the seers themselves. Everyone, in the same way that, like, if God reveals something to you directly, you're bound in conscience to listen to that. But I'm not bound in conscience to listen to that. I'm free to disbelieve you or to believe you because God didn't reveal it to me. I'm bound to believe the Christian faith because that's been revealed to everyone. That's what we mean by public revelation as opposed to private.
All right. So something like the apparitions here in northern Wisconsin, those are still considered private, but approved.
Yes.
And
right.
Okay. Yeah, by approved, we mean they're worthy of belief. They're not teaching some heretical thing. They check out. They seem to be real. But I'm still free to reject every private revelation if I want to. If I want to believe that there are no Marian apparitions, I could hold that belief. I think that's a silly belief to hold, but I could. I mean, because the point of these private revelations is not to introduce some new Christian teaching. In the same way that, like, if you have a dream, if it introduces some new doctrine that wasn't in Christianity, that's a big red flag that that's not of God. On the other hand, if it just is encouraging you, maybe in a more concrete way, to live out the gospel, well, great. Then listen to that and do that if you believe that really is coming from God.
Mike, we're going to leave it there. Thanks very much for the call. Got to head down to Costa Rica now. Heikel in Costa Rica watching on YouTube. Heikel, you there with us?
Yes, hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for the call. We always like to get a call from Costa Rica.
Thank you. I have one question. It is regarding to Jesus. What is the official teaching of the church regarding if Jesus had faith or not? I mean the virtue of faith.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good question. A lot of people get wrong. Hebrews 11 says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So Jesus doesn't have faith. This is very strange when you say, like, you know, Jesus doesn't have faith. If you just leave it at that, people are kind of scandalized. What I mean is that faith is trust in what you don't see. And Jesus enjoys the beatific vision. He sees God from the moment of his conception onward in his humanity. And he is God in addition to that. There's nothing unknown to him. There's nothing that he doesn't see. The reason St. Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about how faith and hope pass away and love doesn't is that faith and hope are these pilgrim virtues. They're things that relate to our earthly journey. And when we enjoy the completion of them in heaven, there will be nothing left to believe in because we'll know it directly, and nothing left to hope for because we'll be experiencing that for which we hoped directly. But we can still love, like love endures in a way the other two don't. As an aside, this is also one of the reasons why the Virgin Mary is so important, is because she is the perfect embodiment of faith. Jesus doesn't have faith, so he can't be our model of faith.
Heikel, does that help you? Is that what you were looking for?
Yes, correct. And which which dogma is related to it? Which Christ dogma is related to it?
Yeah, Jesus' possession of the beatific vision. The Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith issued a note on the works of a theologian by the name of John Sobrino, in which he sort of suggested that Christ didn't have the beatific vision. The Catechism refers to Christ's full and immediate knowledge of God, which is a reference to the beatific vision. And Pius XII teaches this as well. So it is something that the Church has continuously taught, that Jesus has the beatific vision. If by faith you mean what Hebrews 11 means, that is, the conviction of things not seen, you can't think that Jesus is convicted of things he doesn't see and that he sees everything, because those two things can't both be true.
Yes, okay, perfect. That's great.
Great. Thank you very much for the call. Hope we hear from you again.
Thank you very much, guys.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go to Philip up in... Oh, look at this. Oh, we go from Costa Rica to Canada. Up to Philip in Canada. Philip, you there with us? Hi, Philip.
Hey, okay, so my question is kind of weird, but I was wondering if torture is an absolute moral wrong, or can it ever be justified in special circumstances? For example, I was watching a movie this week, and a child kidnapper kidnapped some children and hid them in the forest, and he wouldn't reveal where he had hid the children. Would there ever be a situation where you could use it to extract information that could save lives?
No, I'm very glad you asked that. I think it's actually really dangerous. We have a lot of media that presents torture as this necessary evil. And I think it's really dangerous for two reasons. One, there's actually a lot of evidence that torture is not a particularly effective technique to get the ends, that if you're really trying to get the information, torture is not a reliable way to get it.
It would work on me.
But I'm second, but you wouldn't have to go to the level of torture to
no, that's
just
true.
Ask really nicely. But second, no, you can't do evil so good comes about. St. Paul explicitly says that in the letter to the Romans. In paragraph 2297, we're told that torture, which uses physical or moral violence to extract confessions, punish the guilty, frighten opponents, or satisfy hatred, is contrary to respect for the person and for human dignity. And Benedict XVI made it very clear it cannot be contravened under any circumstance. Like, there's no circumstance in which it's okay to torture. In the same way that you couldn't, say, commit rape, even if you thought it would, you know, make the person reveal where the bomb is and save a million lives. It doesn't matter. You can't do something grossly violating the dignity of another person. It's intrinsically immoral. So it can never be justified. And in the same way, kidnapping and hostage taking are also mentioned. You know, like things like this that are violations of human dignity, you don't get to do those things. It doesn't matter kind of what the stakes are. In the same way that you couldn't kill like an innocent person on purpose to save two innocent people.
What do you think of this, Philip?
Yeah, well, in that case, you know, our options are constant prayer. And in those types of situations, except for prayer, is there anything else that would be wise to do, or just pray and hope that God would help rescue the children?
Yeah, you can still interrogate. And there's more effective means of interrogation. Now, a lot of this gets into a very practical level and very case-specific kind of detail. But, you know, there's carrot and stick. And so there have been effective cases in dealing with murderers or kidnappers where offering a lighter sentence if they'll reveal where the person is has led sometimes to breakthroughs. But other times it just, you can't. Like the evil of that person, you may not be able to stop or control it. And if the only way you can stop or control another person's evil is by doing evil yourself, don't do it.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the answer.
Philip, I want to thank you for the question, because it's actually, you said when you started, oh, it's kind of a weird question, but serious moral questions like that are very, very important that we ask. And sometimes we get in the weeds a little bit on some things, and it's nice to have a good, clear moral question. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know what Joe thinks about this. I think many of us as Catholics are in the habit sometimes of you know, fudging on these things a little bit and going, yeah, it's, you know, in this case, it's all right and that's, but there are things that are absolutely wrong. You cannot do them, and don't do them. Don't kill innocent people directly. Don't torture people on purpose. As Joe said, don't rape anyone. Like these, and there's not an exception. And people will say, well, that's too hard. But that is the truth. It's hard, but that's the truth. Do you think that's true, Joe?
Yeah, I do. I think that this is one of those cases where if I tell you give 100% of your life to God, let no space for the reign of sin, then people say yes. But if I say that means you can't sin even when it would be very convenient to sin,
right,
then people kind of balk at it.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you asked, Philip, because the modern age gives us all these very subtle questions. But sometimes the subtlety is in, well, we're negotiating about things we shouldn't be negotiating about. We should just say, nope, can't do that. What are the other options? So I do appreciate it, Philip. It was fun to get a call from Costa Rica and then Canada. Our number is 888-318-7884. We're going to do this for another hour. So if you're on the line, please stay on the line. And if you haven't called yet, there will be one line open anyways, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer will be back with us. Maybe we'll get Trent to sit down and answer a few questions. That'd be fun to have the two of you in here at one time. We'll see if that'll happen right after this on Catholic Answers Live.